Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we have an incredible horticulture gang assembled today. In a few minutes, we'll get a preview of the Iowa Organic Conference with ISU Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett, and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh will be here. Also, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will be here. They will answer your tree and plant questions. But we're going to start with insects and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you for being here. And I think a week and a half ago, if you'd been on the show, we would have been talking about insect invaders, all those Asian lady beetles and box elder bugs.
And minute pirate bugs that were biting people on warm, sunny days. And all of that's a distant memory.
Absolutely. They've all disappeared because it got cold. And it's amazing how quickly that happens every year. So when that cold snap comes, a lot of insects die, right?
Exactly. They have reached the end of their adult period, or they have done what they're supposed to do, and freezing to death is sort of the final piece of their life cycle. Insects are cold-blooded, a thing we remind ourselves occasionally, and that is their body temperature is the same as the ambient temperature. So when a butterfly is sitting in the sunshine on an 85-degree day, the butterfly is 85 degrees. But when it gets down to 50 degrees and the butterfly is sitting there, the body temperature of the butterfly is about 50 degrees, and that's too cold to operate. So the cold temperatures, number one, slow insects down. And the really cold temperatures either kill them or put them into their winter diapause, a type of hibernation.
So with the insects that die when the cold snap comes, where are their eggs? How have they planned for the next season or made provisions?
Well, the evolution over the millennia has provided a way for that species to be perpetuated. One example is the corn earworm, that big caterpillar that was on the end of the ear of sweet corn when you husked it last year. That moth cannot survive Iowa winters. And any moth that was in Iowa when the freeze came died. But that same species is plugging away down in cotton fields in the south. And so it will survive somewhere else. It just didn't survive here. But next spring, when the winds blow from the south, those moths will repopulate the state. So sometimes it's just a matter of they only died here. They didn't die everywhere. Other insects have laid their eggs, like mosquitoes may have laid their eggs at the water's edge. And those eggs have the ability to make it through the winter, even though for some species of adult mosquitoes, they have died off. The Japanese beetles that were so thick on your linden tree last year laid their eggs in July and August. Those hatched into grubs that are now 4 to 6 inches deep. So they are spending the winter in their larval stage deep in the soil, and the adults all died of old age or freezing, whichever came first.
Now, I want to talk more about some of these insects that go into that kind of hibernation, because I think that's so remarkable when you think about how tiny they are and how brutal our winters can be. It's astonishing to me that any insect can survive through the winter months. So give me an example of a species that does that.
The ability to survive winter is actually better among the insects than it is among us. They have these adaptations. And so let's talk about all the other lady beetles that aren't in your house. The other 25 species in the state of Iowa that are out there, most of them climbed under brush piles. They climbed under tufts of tall grass. They climbed under the loose bark of dead trees. And as the days got shorter and as the temperatures lowered, their body began to produce a form of antifreeze, a glycerol compound, that will keep ice from forming in their cells as they hide in these protected locations. So getting into the protected location is part of it. all of those yellow jacket wasps that were burrowing in the ground last year and coming out and stinging you as you ran by with your lawnmower, that colony of a few hundred wasps all froze to death except for the queens, the new queens that were able to get out of the ground. They mated with a male somewhere. They have gone into hibernation under the loose bark of a dead tree. The entire perpetuation of the species has now been invested in those few fertile females making it through the winter so that they can start from scratch next year. It won't be 100%, but it'll be good enough that next year we'll have yellow jacket wasps again, even though the colony of hundreds just died off a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and they do seem to do pretty well because we obviously see them every year. Do we have an idea what percentage does survive? Because they're playing some pretty long odds, aren't they?
They're playing very long odds, but they are adapted to it. One way to answer that question is to think about how many offspring does a female need to produce for the population, for the species, to be successful? And for most of these insects, that answer would be two. That female wasp really needs to produce one new female and one new male to replace the breeding population. So out of 1,000 gypsy moth eggs that are laid and make it in the summertime to make it through the winter and hatch next spring as caterpillars eating the leaves off of trees in the forests of northeastern United States, out of 1,000 eggs, if two of them make it to the adult moth stage, that is success. And I think it's about that bad of an odds for most insects. There's very high failure, but they start with such high numbers that high failure rates don't matter because we still end up at the same place at the end.
Now, if we wanted to go out and try to find these insects that have crawled into the brush to hibernate, is it possible? Can you go find a colony of lady beetles that are hibernating for the winter?
Sometimes. That one's a little harder to find here in our climate, but there are places where lady beetle hibernating clusters are so thick, and we're talking about the foothills of the Colorado Rocky Mountains, that they go out in the winter and they scrape up jars full of these lady beetles and put them in the refrigerator so they can sell them to you next spring. So there are places.
Beneficial for my garden.
That's right. Well, beneficial for the ecosystem. Maybe they won't stay in your garden, but there are places where this happens. Now, more often, it's just sort of this random accident that we're chopping wood and the bark falls off and, oh, look, there's a lady beetle, or look, there's a centipede hiding in there, or, gee, that looks like a wasp that has climbed in there to hibernate through the winter. It's not really easy to do, but obviously they're out there and obviously they're going to make it.
One of the things that really astonishes me is when you have the first few warm days of spring, we go from no insects to suddenly there are insects there. So when it does start to warm up, what happens?
There are those insects that spend the winter in the adult stage. And as we look at insects with a complete life cycle, egg, larva, pupa, and adult, there are those that spend the winter as eggs, some as caterpillars or larvae, some as pupae, a few as adults. For example, the mourning cloak butterfly is out there in Iowa hiding in a brush pile somewhere, and as soon as the body temperature of that insect gets above about 55 or 60 degrees, they will be active. Lots of flies spend the winter in the adult stage. So they've gone into hibernation, but if they're sitting in a sunny area, when the sun comes out and warms them up, they're ready to go. We also see some species of mosquitoes. Out of our 50 different species, some spend the winter in the adult stage. And as soon as their body temperature reaches the activation point, boom, there they are. They can take off and work right away.
Always a welcome appearance.
Always glad to see them. But honeybees do the same thing. Honeybees cluster in their hive, and they stay warm by shivering, and the colony keeps itself active through the winter. And when springtime comes, they're ready to go. And as soon as the air temperature allows, they will be out looking for nectar and pollen to start building up the stores again of what they've depleted over the winter. So insects that winter in the adult stage are the ones that we can see very early in the spring. And all it took was the warmth to get them back up to operating temperature.
And, of course, there is an insect that we do get glimpses of during the winter months when there's snow on the ground. When you have a nice day and you're out in the woods, you can look at the snow and it looks like there's this tiny dusting of dirt on it.
Uh-huh.
But if you look a lot closer, you find that those are insects. Snow fleas are what they're called, right?
Yeah, snow fleas are one of those oddities that just sort of defies explanation, that here's a little tiny insect, only about a 16th of an inch long. They're one of the springtails, and so they jump by springing off of their tail end. And on warm, sunny days, they will be active on top of the snow. Then you think to yourself, how did you get enough heat into your body to resume activity like that? And of course, they're black, and often they're hiding on the bare ground next to the snowbank, and we wouldn't see them if they were active down there, but by hopping around, they get up on the snow and we see them. Snow fleas are one of those things that you just have to stand back and say, wow, those can make it through the winter and be successful, and they're there every year.
Now, of course, you can't see the future about how brutal this winter might be. But every time it gets really, really cold, people start asking you, Donald, does that mean that we're not going to have the Japanese beetle this summer or this or that? I mean, talking about all of these adaptations, it sounds like they're going to do okay almost no matter what.
Almost no matter what. And, of course, we're talking about 20,000 different species of insects in the state of Iowa. And it's this high variability that sort of makes any prediction pretty worthless. The insects are adapted for the cold. If they get cold and stay cold, there's usually no problem surviving. The toughest winters for insects are ones where it goes to 20 below, and then the next day it's 40 above, and then it goes 20 below again. Those alternating cold temperatures are actually much harder on insects than just the absolute cold. But we have seen years where the frost got into the ground back in the winter of 2013-14, and it did reduce the Japanese beetle population around the state, but it didn't eliminate it. And what we found was in 2 years, they bounced back.
They certainly did. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Iowa State University Extension Entomologist, Professor of Entomology at ISU, Donald Lewis. Coming up in just a minute, the rest of the Hort Gang will join us, and they'll also answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis, also joining the conversation now. We've got ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And Mark Vitosh is here, DNR District Forester. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
And it is a true Hort Gang today. We've got a lot of experts on the air. Iowa State University Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett is also here. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello, Charity.
And before we dive into answering questions, but as you can tell, you can ask questions about insects, organic gardening, any other gardening, landscape questions, tree questions. We've got you covered today, no matter what. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. So Kathleen, is it the 17th annual Iowa Organic Conference is coming up here in just over a week, really, November 19th and 20th, right?
Please give me 2 weeks.
Okay, 2 weeks. It is 2 weeks. I'm getting ahead of myself. But tell me what you're working on this year. What are people expecting?
Right. It's really exciting. It's our 17th annual, and this is now the sixth year we've been here in Iowa City, because the majority of organic farmers, as you know, are on the eastern part of the state, so that's why we moved the conference to Iowa City. And this year we have our keynote speaker, Jeff Moyer, who's the executive director of Rodale Institute from Pennsylvania, coming to cheer us on since they've been in business for 70 years now at Rodale, and talking about how we still need more organic farmers to meet demand.
And for people who don't know, what is Rodale?
Rodale is the largest and oldest organic research facility in the United States. I think they have something like 200 acres, and they have the longest running comparison of organic and conventional crops in the country.
So you said we need more organic farmers to meet demand. So this has been such a tremendous period of growth for organic gardening in or organic farming and gardening in Iowa. And the conference has grown as well. You're finding a lot more people are interested in learning about this.
Absolutely. And, well, as we were saying, the demand has never been so high. What really saddens us is when we have to go overseas to fill the demand. And there's a lot of concern about that. We'll have a session on that, about how we're dealing with imports, because we need to make sure they are meeting certified organic rules when a lot of imports come in to make up for the demand. And but overall, the industry's been growing about 11%. It's a $47 billion industry now, and no end in sight, as far as I can tell.
Well, and you have speakers, of course, from all over the country who come and are a part of this. It's the Iowa Organic Conference. Are you finding that people from surrounding states are also being drawn in?
Right. Yeah. I just got a call from Kentucky. This farmer wants to come up from that. So I think in general, we have at least five states represented. But the furthest we've had some folks from Canada that come down, too.
So in addition to sharing information and advice and sharing stories, what do you feel are the topics really that are top of mind for organic farmers this year?
Well, it's always transitioning to organic, weed management. I'm excited to say it's the first time we're going to have a local Amish farmer, Eldon T. Miller, talking about organic chicken production. And Doug Darrow from Rapid Creek Ranch will be joining him on that, because chickens, eggs are actually the number one valued commodity, organic commodity in Iowa. So that's been really growing. And we also have, I'm really excited, we're having what I call millennial organic farmer from Montana, Nate Palm, come and talk. And he's been getting all kinds of press about, you know, millennials entering organic, which apparently is the millennials that are parents is the largest group of organic consumers in the United States now.
Oh, interesting.
So finding out, you know, how it is, if you're a new farmer and you want to transition to organic, what are the challenges? What are the opportunities? Nate will be presenting on that.
And, of course, talking about transitioning to organic, that's an incredibly challenging thing for a lot of people. For a lot of small operations, it's really expensive, really difficult to get that organic certification. Are you also talking to farmers who want to farm organically but can't afford that certification?
Right. And we have, I would guess, maybe there's probably 100 organic farmers in Iowa that aren't certified. They know their clientele base and they can visit the farm and are assured of the practices they're using are organic. But they can't call it organic because of the federal rules, so they can't put organic on their label. So they're really restricted to just that small marketplace. If they want to sell to any Hy-Vee or Whole Foods, they would need that certificate. And there's a lot of cost-share programs. IDOLS offers one that's supported by USDA that could help smaller farmers get certified. And there's also a $5,000 exemption. So if you sell less than $5,000 a year, you don't have to pay for certification fees.
One of the interesting things that I've found doing interviews with various farmers is there seem to be more and more overlap approaches between conventional and organic farmers. I mean, of course, one of the big movements in Iowa right now, not maybe as big as you would like it to be, but it's growing dramatically, are cover crops. So, I mean, some of those ideas, those practices that really cover all kinds of farming, do you focus on those as well?
Right, and we look for that because we want to encourage more people to make the transition through using sustainable practices like cover crops, extended crop rotations, composting, things like that. And, yeah, we've always had cover crops in our research projects. As a matter of fact, we just planted our rye and hairy vetch yesterday.
Oh, wow. So not too late?
Not too late. As long as the ground's not frozen, you can get that seed in the ground. That's all you need to be concerned about.
I saw a cover crop going in this week, and I thought, it seems late.
Right. It's fortunately, with global climate change, we've been able to get them in later and later. So, yeah, I don't know what the weather prediction is, but you probably do have another week or so to get them in.
All right.
The earlier you get them in, the better it will be. But if you're running behind with everything like we are.
And who isn't? Right. So, all right, the Organic Conference is coming up November 19th and 20th at the Iowa Memorial Union in Iowa City. We put up a link to your website on our Facebook page at Thank Iowa you. Public Radio, also on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. And when do people need to sign up by?
Well, we're extending the early registration to November 12th because we know how busy everybody is. People are still harvesting. We're still harvesting our corn, hopefully today. So we're giving people the week before, up to the week before. So after November 12th, it'll go up $20.
All right. So start making plans. And again, you can find more information on our website and on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio, and also on our Twitter feed, the Iowa Organic Conference, the 17th annual, coming up in just a couple of weeks. With me, ISU Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron, and ISU Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. They are all here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. The lines are open. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. The first question of the day goes to Larry from Alden. He says, does it harm bushes or small trees if lower branches are loosely bundled, lifting the tips upward before placing protective winter barriers around them? The cord will be removed together with the barriers next March or April.
It should not. Should be okay.
All right. That shouldn't be a concern?
Shouldn't be, no.
But is it important that he actually removes the barriers in March or April?
It shouldn't be permanent, and you want something that is wide enough that it's not going to cut into the actual stem or trunk.
All right. And Mark, did you hear my apology to you last week about doubting the fall color? It wasn't so bad. We did get some beautiful fall color.
I use the word hodgepodge a lot for this fall. Depending on where you were, it was, you know, really pretty in places, but there was some blahness to a lot of places. And I appreciate your apology. I did not hear it, but you gave it to me this morning. I will tell folks, I actually talked to our area forester down in Stevens State Forest in Sheraton this morning through email, and there's still some fall color out there. The oaks, the purples of the, basically the reds and purples of the red oaks and the white oaks are still trying to show. Some places didn't get as hard a frost as others. So there's still some mixed colors as you go in the southern part of the state.
All right, so maybe a road trip down south for the coming weekend. Although we had a lot of wind last
weekend. Well, she did mention that the browns of the hickories are starting to show and stuff, but there is a kind of a rusty red is the term that she used in some of the hills.
All right. And if the sun would come out, I'm sure it would be lovely.
That's right.
Maybe we'll see a bit of sunshine.
But through your towns, too, and some of your communities, especially in south central Iowa and even in the Iowa City area, some of the red maples are still showing and stuff. So there's scattering of life still out there.
All right. Here's a question from Laura in Cedar Rapids. Can you tell me how to rid my yard of grubs? I found one this week as I pulled weeds and had to reseed a good portion of my yard due to damage this fall.
One, huh? Well, one is not the issue. Where the grass was killed by white grubs, you usually have 10 or more per square foot. So it takes a lot of grubs to be a problem in turf grass. And, as she's described, it's always a spot. It's not that your lawn is going to die like it would if it were a disease. It's not your lawn is turning brown like it would if it were dormancy. But there will be this spot that the grubs accumulated in that area because that's where the females laid their eggs. And they ate so many grass roots that the grass suffered as a result of it. One of your options is to repair the spot and go on with life. That if it doesn't happen to you often, if it doesn't happen to you regularly, you can live with the damage and just replace what was damaged this year. However, if your tolerance for grubs is that of a golf course, which is zero, if you cannot face the risk of having any grubs in your lawn, then the treatment is to use an insecticide in May, June, or July that is specifically formulated for grub control. These are insecticides that you spread on the ground, on the grass, especially in those areas where you've had damage in the past. You either wait for the rain to water it in or you water in the insecticide, and that will kill the small grubs as they appear in August. So it's a preventive treatment. You don't know you need it until it's too late to apply it. So it's just one of those things you have to figure out what is your risk, what is your tolerance, and either use the insecticides because you have no tolerance or no risk, you're not willing to take the risk of grubs, or take that risk and repair the lawn when necessary.
Reseed in August.
Yeah, well,
correct, yes.
unfortunately, the reseeding part of that is a bit difficult because it's often September or October before we actually know that the grubs ruined the lawn in that spot. And so it's not an easy mix of things to calculate that, okay, I'm going to need to reseed. But so you're pushing your luck to reseed as late as possible. Is it too late to reseed my bare spots, Richard?
At this point, yes.
Okay, thanks. Yes. Just checking.
Although you can still get a cover crop in, maybe this weekend.
Who knew? So the white grub treatment is not an easy decision for a lot of people to make. That it's an expensive thing. It's a lot of insecticide. It's a synthetic insecticide. The natural biological controls aren't working well for us this far north, with a possible new exception. But it's a tough decision for people to make. Should I use the insecticide and not take the risk, or just take my lumps?
All right. Well, let's go to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Sophie is on the line in Lamoni. Hi, Sophie.
Hi. I have a couple of fruit tree questions. I bought two quince trees and one died. And I do have pear and apples around, and I wondered if I need to get another quince to replace it to help the one that's left to fruit or not.
All right. So will a quince tree be self-pollinating?
Is it a true quince?
Yes.
Okay. They're kind of marginally hardy in Iowa. I think you'd have better luck if you had two. As far as production-wise.
Okay.
And she's down in Lamoni. Does that
helps.
Her?
That definitely helps.
If you
were in Waterloo, that wouldn't work at all as far as it wouldn't be hardy. So it's basically in Iowa at its northern limit as far as hardiness.
Uh-huh. Okay. And the other question is I planted some chestnut trees. And then I discovered that I already had one that's kind of half dying, but I still find some chestnuts on the ground, but they are very tiny, and I think it's a single lone tree there. So will the young growing chestnuts help that old chestnut maybe make bigger chestnuts?
Okay. Now, this is a true chestnut or a horse chestnut? I'm assuming a chestnut.
Well, the one that is growing, that is there, I really don't know what type of chestnut is.
Okay.
But the one I planted where across.
Is the husk spiny on the one that lays on the ground?
Okay, so you're growing in these for the edible nuts or seeds, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you
but they're very small.
Okay. The question would be, if they're very small, are the seeds actually inside those fruit, are they viable? I don't know on that. I guess I would try. I would take them out and plant them in the ground and see what they do. But my guess is if they're real small, they may not be viable. But I'd go ahead and plant them, maybe about an inch deep. If they do sprout and grow, it's going to be many years before they're big enough to actually themselves flower and produce fruit. So maybe 10 or 15 years in the future if they actually manage to sprout.
Mark, have you seen any American chestnuts in your region lately?
Yes, I have. There's one on the University of Iowa campus that they've collected cyanwood from before, and there's a few others in the area, but that's one that does produce a little bit.
Okay. Of course, tell us the chestnut blight story in a nutshell.
You got 30 seconds.
Well, chestnut is a native species, but with chestnut blight, it's basically a systemic disease and basically was introduced, and that disease has wiped out the majority of chestnuts throughout the U.S. On the east and the Appalachians and stuff, chestnut was a viable species, very viable species, and it didn't quite make it this far as a native species. It does grow here, but most of the range maps you look at probably didn't make it this far. That disease is still out there. They've worked very hard to develop some disease-resistant selections. Chinese chestnut is used quite a bit as an alternative because it is fairly tolerant to the disease. But if you just plant an American chestnut now, just from a regular strain, your chances of that disease still impacting it is still there.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, ISU Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran, ISU Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett. They're here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran, ISU Extension Organic Specialist Kathleen Dellett, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, and Iowa State University Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. They are all here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kathleen, we've got a question for you from Deborah in West Branch. She wants to get your thoughts on the recent controversy over the decision to allow or not allow hydroponics and aquaponics in organic certification.
Wow, right off the bat, a really controversial
right.
question. Yeah, it is very controversial. And being a neutral scientist, I'm not going to give an opinion one way or another because I get questions on organic hydroponics, or at least doing hydroponics in an organic fashion, and I answer those questions and work with those people. So I'm not registering an opinion. I can tell you what the two sides are. The one side
sure.
is saying that all organic food, for that matter, should be grown in soil. That's the basis, the premise of organic, that there's healthy soil behind the plant or under the plant. So those proponents are very strong. However, they just lost the first round. There was a meeting in Jacksonville, Florida this week, the National Organic Standards Board, and the vote came down 8-4 organic hydroponics being legal, 7 against. So I wouldn't exactly call that a consensus, but they did majority rule. So it's now moving to the second stage of actually codifying it and making it allowable. Stay tuned. I think it's the battle's still going on.
All right. So we will hear more about that in coming months and coming years, probably. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Linda is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Linda.
Hello and happy November.
Oh, thank you. What's your question?
Well, I have two questions. They're much lighter than the last question was. One is a bug question and one is a tree question. The bug question is, what happened to my praying mantises this winter? Did they die? Are they hibernating or what? And then the tree question is, I just have survived the barrage of walnuts. We seem to have a bumper crop this year, and the walnut, the stems and the leaves. And my maples are still turning, but this week I noticed there was quite a few trees in my area here in Des Moines. They're fan-shaped leaves. I believe they're ginkgo trees.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like one night they suddenly said, we're done. They're bright green leaves, and they dropped them all. It was just like boom.
Yeah, leaves falling like
green.
Raindrops. Yep.
And cars were carpeted with green, and I wondered, is this normal, or was it just from this year, or what?
All right, we'll do the ginkgos first. Mark?
That is normal, and that actually makes them very rake friendly because normally with ginkgos, they are one that they actually have a very nice rich yellow fall color depending on the variety and selection. But they're one, if you get a hard frost, they will abscise, and those leaves generally will fall off in one night. I noticed in my neighborhood, though, depending on how they were kind of grouped and if they were protected by other trees, the ones that were protected by other trees did not have their leaves fall off or did not fall off as much. But the ones that were more open really dropped quickly. And that is a normal thing with ginkgos is if those leaves are green and you get a hard frost, they will drop in 1 or 2 days after that.
I saw a lot of mulberry trees doing the same thing.
They did the same, yes.
Are there other trees that do that too?
I would say ginkgo and mulberry are the two that tend to do it the most. Silver maple's one too that when you get a really hard frost, a lot of times they'll start falling. But the ginkgo's the one that really kind of leads the way.
All right.
So it makes them very yard friendly sometimes in a sense compared to, I love oaks, but oaks will drop leaves for, you know, three months.
3 months. It's now till spring.
Come on, guys. I was trying to be somewhat conservative.
All right. And the praying mantis question.
The praying mantis story is the adults mate and lay eggs in the fall of the year. And the egg is a foam pod. It's about the size of a golf ball. It's usually attached to plant stems or shrub stems or flower stems 2 to 3 feet off the ground. So as the leaves dry up and blow away on plants, you may find these praying mantis foamy egg cases out there. And every case has 150 to 200 eggs inside of it. The adults that produce that egg case have frozen to death. So they did what they needed to do. They reproduced. They laid their eggs before they died in the freeze. But those eggs are out there 2 to 3 feet off the ground, waiting for spring, probably next May, until they hatch. That means they have to survive as eggs the freezing temperatures, the blowing winds, the blowing snow, the sleet and hail that's going to hit them. And as far north as we are, most of them will not. This is a southern species where the eggs do well in the south and even up into Missouri. But by the time you get to Iowa, the survival of those eggs falls off dramatically. And I think by the time we get to Ames or Waterloo, even though we see praying mantises, we don't see very much survival of the egg cases. So they will survive down south. They will be back next year. They may not be the direct descendants of the praying mantis you had this year, but they are all related and they're all beneficial.
All right. And Mark, you had a follow-up praying mantis
question. Yes, Dr. Lewis. What is the foam made of?
Well, the foam is a material that is produced the same way that cockroaches produce the capsule that holds their eggs. And so it's just a little more foamy. It's a little more lightweight. And the eggs are toward the middle of it. And then they deposit this foam from their tail end. They deposit this foam around the outside.
I was curious what end it came from.
It's
delightful.
Thank you.
It comes from the same end as the eggs do.
Okay.
But right. To Charity's earlier comment, that egg case may have 150 to 200 eggs, and if two adults survive from that, that's a miracle and it's a success. Out of all those eggs that were there at the start of the winter, how many adults will we have from that egg case next year? It may be none. It could be one or two, and that's okay.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Lynn is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Okay, my question, I have one question and one comment. I've been hearing about Navajo juniper ash, and I went online and I saw the procedure for creating the ash, but I didn't see anything that said what, if it was a juniper bush. I didn't know if it was those bushes with those little blue berries in it or if there's such a thing as a juniper tree. So the Navajo.
Okay, describe what you're talking about. Juniper ash? This is
the Navajos take the branches and they burn them into an ash and they mix it with cornmeal and it gives them like super, super strong bones.
Okay.
But I didn't know what type
of tree you could use for it. All right, Mark, do you have any insight on that?
Well, our only native, we have two native junipers, Juniperus communis and Juniperus virginiana, which is eastern red cedar, but I don't know which juniper they use for that.
But it only comes as bushes and not as trees?
Well, those two that I mentioned are actually trees as far as native in Iowa. But what I would try to find, if you can do research, is to see what – it'll be juniperus, but see what species it is. Then you would know if it's a shrub or a tree.
Oh, okay.
So look at the scientific name. If you can find the scientific name of the plant that they're using, then that would be able to tell you if it's a tree or shrub. Then you can find out for sure.
Oh, okay. So I don't go to a place where I see the juniper, because the juniper bushes grow the little blueberries, correct?
Which is actually, it's a berry-like cone. It's actually a conifer, so that's actually the cone. But the trees also, what we call eastern red cedar is actually a juniper, Juniperus virginiana. That is the cone, but there are shrubs of junipers, too, that will also produce those berry-like cones. So it's actually, they're actually a cone, but they're berry-like. Bird species. But what you need to find out is through your literature to see what actual genus and species of plant they're using, then that'll tell you specific. Because my guess is they're probably using a specific plant. And if it's down in the south, it could be...
Yeah, it's Navajo Nation.
It could be alligator juniper. There's pincho juniper. There's a variety of junipers. I used to live in Oklahoma, so I know there's other junipers.
Okay. Because the stuff they were burning did not have the berries. They didn't say, like, remove the blueberries.
Find out the genus species and then go from there.
All right.
And
you had a comment, too?
I had a comment. The woman who was asking about the white grubs.
Sure.
The grubs in her lawn. This isn't how to get rid of them, but this is kind of an environmental thing. I came across some baby birds many years ago, and I knew somebody who was a wildlife specialist with birds. And the birds and the baby birds died, and I was very distraught. And she told me that often, and she looked at what they were, and she said, those are birds who the mother eats grubs. They're grub-eating birds. She said what often happens is people put insecticide in their lawns to kill the grubs or whatever the chemical is. He said that the adult birds are pretty much large enough to handle the poison, but then when they regurgitate and feed the babies, then they poison their babies. So he said, so you're kind of cross between, well, do you want the grubs or do you want to have a food source for the birds?
Yeah. I think that's less of an issue than it used to be because of the insecticides we're using now compared to just 10 years ago. The ones we have now are very specific to insects and don't have the wildlife consequences of the organophosphates we were using 10 to 15 years ago, and certainly not the consequences of the organochlorines that we were using 25 to 30 years ago. So things have improved in that regard, but it's still common sense to not use insecticides unless you need them. Back to your juniper ash, Charity, you'll be interested to know that NPR, if you can trust that source, ran a story on this August 21st, 2017 on Morning Edition.
All right. So we can do more research on the NPR.org website. All right. Let's go to Bob in Bettendorf. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I have to give a presentation on the city's strategic plan for emerald ash borer, and I anticipate we're going to get a question is, are we going to have to treat these trees forever? Now, one thing I have found out that after the population peaks and all the trees, untreated trees, are dead, then the emerald ash borer population will tank. But has there been any new research on how we can space out the treatments after that?
Well, right now, the best we know is to tell people to plan to treat the trees they want to protect with insecticide every other year. Someday that may become every third year, and someday it may become not every tree, that you move it around because there are so few left. But right now, we're still saying plan on treating every tree that you plan to protect every other year. It's not good information for most people. They don't like to hear that. And they also don't like to hear, well, your alternative is replace the tree with a different species. So of those options, especially as you're looking at a town, you can do your tree inventory and find those areas that have an abundance of ash now and plan on thinning that herd and replacing them with other kinds of trees that Mark and his group at Iowa, at the DNR, and the group here at Iowa State University in horticulture have these lists of good replacement trees.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Bob. Next, we'll go to Nicole in Kelowna. Hi, Nicole. Oh, I think we've lost Nicole. Joe is on the line in Fredericksburg. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. At the end of the summer, we lost a favorite apple tree to the wind. We were still able to harvest some of the apples, but our problem now is I don't know what type of tree it was. Is there any way that I can tell from the apple itself or from the wood what type of tree it was?
Not from the wood, possibly from the fruit. Basically, what we would need here at Iowa State would be two or three apples, mature apples that are unblemished. Because what we basically do is we base identification on the actual color, the coloring on the actual fruit, and also the shape. So if you have two or three mature apples, they're basically unblemished. If you want to send those to Iowa State, we can give you an idea. We can't guarantee that we can ID it, but we'll give you some idea what it might be.
Okay, and what department do they go to down there?
You can just send it to entomology. Excuse me.
I don't want your
just
apples.
A snack.
You don't want the apples. Horticulture Extension.
Okay.
Iowa State University.
Mm-hmm.
Ames, Iowa, 50011.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Joe. And final call of the day, Dave in Solon. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Love the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your
question? I got a wildflower planting question. I got two approximately 100-foot by 20-foot wildflower beds tilled and raked and was reading to wait until after the first frost. It's a mix of annual and perennial wildflowers. Since it's going to be rainy and possibly warmer this weekend, I wondered if I should wait or go ahead and plant this afternoon.
I would try to do it probably now before it rains. You want to be able to somehow kind of work the seed into the soil. That's the prime thing, is to get it into the soil. And so if the seed bed is ready to go, I think I'd do it now.
All right, Dave, something to do today or tomorrow then before the rain comes.
If you just have a light yard roller or something, Dave, to roll over that, because you just want the seed to be just in contact with that soil and you don't want to bury it, so you don't want to recultivate it. You just want to lay it on top and just make contact with that soil.
All right. Dave, thanks a lot for your call, and we are out of time for Horticulture Day today. We will not be back with Horticulture next Friday on the 10th because we have a special opportunity to hear an On Point that will be taking place in Iowa, but we'll be back again the week after that. And thank you so much, Donald Lewis, for being here today.
Always a pleasure, Charity.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Kathleen Dellett, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Charity.
ISU Extension organic specialist. You can find out more information about the upcoming Iowa Organic Conference on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio and also our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. It's coming up November 19th and 20th. Mark Vitosh, thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy the remaining fall color.
All right. And Richard Geron, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.